Have a request here this morning. It says on July 28th, 2007, Andrew E. Bell and Bethany J. Bell of Longview, Texas, were baptized into the Church of Christ Temple Lot. Their parents are members of our local church. Andrew and Bethany are requesting that their membership be placed in our local. So, it's my pleasure this morning to introduce our brother Johnny to be our speaker this morning. I'm sure that he would appreciate your silent prayers as he brings us the word this morning, Brother Johnny.
Thank you, David. Some years ago, we were considerably alarmed when the Supreme Court of the United States passed or made a decision that effectively removed prayer from our public schools. And, of course, there are those who have gone to some length to try to work around that with not a great deal of success. But we might be inclined to say that Satan was encouraged with his success. And I don't know how well we observe that now there is a very large and very well-funded organization working from that beginning. They consist largely of people in the liberal media and politicians and entertainers who have great amounts of money that they can spend for the agendas that they seek. And they're a number of years into their campaign to have any reference to God purged from all of our national records and governmental proceedings. And 5 years ago, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals of the United States ruled in their favor that the phrase "under God" in our Pledge of Allegiance was unconstitutional. The Supreme Court reversed that decision, but one thing I'm sure we don't really realize is the strangeness of that decision. Three justices of the Supreme Court spoke in favor of leaving the Pledge of Allegiance as it was, 3 out of 9. 5 of them kind of hid behind procedural tactics of some sort and said that the group that brought the suit had no legal standing to file such a suit. One justice, the one remaining, recused himself from the sharing in the decision because he had made a strong speech publicly in favor of the pledge as it stands. It looks like we had 4 for it, except that one of those 4 wrote in her opinion that it should not be changed because that expression, that phrase, "under God," was meaningless. It kind of makes the hair stand up, doesn't it? To think that something over 90% of Americans have voiced the opinion that we are a nation established upon godly principles, and yet such a small number stand able to reverse things and say that the name of God is meaningless. a greater number of those who voted in the Congress to insert that phrase in 1954, and President Eisenhower, who signed it, are long, long since dead. But I can't help but wonder what their response would have been if such a thing had been brought to the surface in their time. I think that they would have been extremely indignant to think that there was even that much power exerted in the United States to deny God's part in the establishment and the continuance of our nation. We have numerous scriptures in the Book of Mormon that tell how this nation would be a nation of promise and would never be brought into any degree of bondage so long as it serves God. And on the other hand, if it ceased to serve God, then its fate would be terrible. I may read some of that shortly. I'm convinced that the reason these people want to have the name of God removed from all these actions is because they're uncomfortable at hearing his name spoken reverently. I've seen this among people many times. When dire circumstances existed and they were being spoken of back and forth among the people that I worked with, some were very, very embarrassed to be asked whether or not they thought God had a hand in it. People readily use the name of God profanely. Many, many church-going people that I have known use it with not one hint of reverence, but use it plenty. In fact, we used to have a saying about one of the men that I worked with, and when we would hear him making his profound announcements, and somebody would shake their head and say, "He's got the words, but not the tune." And of course, it was we copied that from Mark Twain, because when people use the name of the Lord without reverence, they have the words, but not the tune. I'm also convinced that these people are in rebellion against God. They don't want to be reminded that they believe in God, but that they know right from wrong, and they prefer wrong. And so, for the most part, they convince themselves that there is no God, and that whatever they decide is right, and we hear that taught in some churches. You decide what is right for you, and then it's right. Well, we have two books full of very meaningful scripture that tell us that God decided what was right and what was wrong before he put a man on the earth, and that he has not changed. And so, unhappily, we have to only suppose that these people who take these contrary positions are going to have them come back to haunt them, like we have had some examples of that are quoted for us. And I want to remind you of Cory Hoar in the Book of Mormon, who rose up and gained considerable popularity teaching the people that there was no God. And when Alma remonstrated with him, Alma was the high priest of the church. The church had a high priest in those days. We don't now. We have a different type of organization since the Lord served in his ministry. So Alma challenged him, and he challenged Alma back, and he said, "I won't believe unless you show me a sign." Well, the sign wasn't quite what he would have had, but he got the sign. I want to read for you in Alma, the 16th chapter, page 414, beginning at verse 60. Now Corihor said unto him, "I do not deny the existence of a God, but I do not believe there is a God. And I say also that ye do not know that there is a God, and except ye show me a sign, I will not believe." Now Alma said unto him, "This will I give thee for a sign, that thou shalt be struck dumb, according to my words. And I say that in the name of God, ye shall be struck dumb, ye shall no more have utterance." Now when Alma had said these words, Corihor was struck dumb, that he could not have utterance according to the words of Alma. And now when the chief judge saw this, he put forth his hand and wrote unto Corihor, saying, this assumes that he was also struck deaf, but it doesn't say so. But at any rate, the judge wrote to him, saying, "Art thou convinced of the power of God? In whom did ye desire that Alma should show forth his sign? Would ye that he should afflict others to show unto thee a sign? Behold, he has showed unto you a sign." Excuse me. "And now will ye dispute more?" And Corihor put forth his hand and wrote, "I know that I am dumb, for I cannot speak. And I know that nothing save it were the power of God could bring this upon me. Yea, and I also knew there was a God." When push comes to shove, it seems that regardless how stout people's words have been, it comes to them with surety that there is a God. And it came to him. I want to read on just a little bit because he explains why he's in the circumstances he's in. Verse 67, "But behold, the devil hath deceived me, for he appeared to me in the form of an angel, and said unto me, Go and reclaim this people, for they have all gone astray after an unknown God. And he said unto me, There is no God. Yea, and he taught me that which I should say. And I have taught his words, and I taught them because they were pleasing unto the carnal mind. And I taught them even until I had much success, insomuch that I verily believed that they were true. And for this cause I withstood the truth, even until I have brought this great curse upon me." Well, we know, if we are familiar with the story, and if we're not, I urge you to read it from there. It's not very long. That it tells us that he came then to an ignoble end. But he knew. And I believe that the people who insist to us that they know there's not a God really know when it comes time that they stare the grim reaper in the face that there is. I remember many, many years ago my mother saying that there was a common saying in the First World War that there are no atheists in the trenches, where the men were fighting and dying, as we have men doing in this time. They believed in God. They believed wholeheartedly in God. James had something to say about that we need to consider. Because he takes it from a wide angle and gives us to understand about it. Chapter 2. Verse 19. He was speaking of faith and works and how one must support the other or neither one exists. But I want to pick this one verse out of it. Thou believest that there is one God, thou doest well. The devils also believe and tremble. Some of the later translations of the Bible kind of tame that down and water it down some, but it still gets the general thought through. And I was a few years ago in a deep discussion of this in another church, and I believe that that what David or what James was saying to them there was a little sarcastic. You believe there's one God. Well, bully for you. What makes you strange when you believe there's one God? Even the devils believe, and they're scared half to death. Why should they tremble? They were the ones who were deceived in heaven by Satan. That third of the angels that it speaks of in the revelations that were cast out of heaven with the devil and became his angels. They rebelled against certain knowledge. They had been in the presence of God. They knew that for them there is no hope. There can be no restoration of their standing before God. Very few men, mortals, are in position to rebel against certain knowledge such as that. We have very good reason to believe there's a God, but we have not seen him. And so we are not in position to go to the extent that we would be beyond the provision for repentance that those angels are in. Men can deny and they can blaspheme and they can live an unrighteous life, and still the right to repent and change their lives is held out before them. Not so with those who left heaven with the devil. We can be grateful for that. If we take the story of Joseph Smith and read it in our little outline history, which doesn't have a great deal of information and doesn't take very long to read, we find that Joseph was persecuted severely from before his 15th birthday because he told a minister of one of the popular churches of that day that he had seen a vision from God and that there were golden plates buried in the earth from which a valuable part of the scripture was going to be translated. And he was persecuted by his neighbors, by people who had been his friends. And they were led by the local ministry of the various churches. And the churches were in quite an agitated state of energy to get out and evangelize and bring people into their churches. And in our history, they call it the golden age of evangelism. About 40 years there, ending really in 1830 when the Book of Mormon came forth and their work kind of died down. I'm convinced that they opposed him because they were afraid that he was right. They were afraid he had a vision, that he was telling the truth. And it was going to upset their whole apple cart, because the things that they had been teaching denied any such heavenly visitations. It's beginning to creep into society now for the last 40 or 50 years, but it certainly was not then. And I can remember when, if you said that God intervened in your life, you would be ridiculed by everybody around you, nearly, except the people in our own church. Well, it went on for a number of years. He was told to come and visit the place that the angel had shown him once a year for 4 years. And he did that. They were in a stone box on this hill and covered with a flat stone that was visible that just walking by. Had grass growing around and over the edges of it as if it had been there a long time. And I'm sure that when he told the people where he had seen this box, that they sought for it with all vigor, that they hunted day and night to try to find it, not only to put a stop to this work, but also to enrich themselves, because he said the place for gold. And what you and I know, but they wouldn't have known, is it doesn't really make any difference how hidden or how exposed it might be. What God conceals, man does not find. And so they couldn't. I've seen pictures of this hill, and it's pretty open and pretty large, not heavily timbered at all. But that really doesn't make much difference, because I believe that between then and now, if it had been timbered, the men would have cut the trees and pulled the stumps. And they would have plowed the hill. And now in more recent times, they have no doubt searched it with metal detectors. And maybe in the most recent times, the last 10 or 12 years, he may have even had access to ground-penetrating radar to search it. Because I know that there are those in the world who would like to put a stop to what he said about it, because he also said there were other plates that he was not permitted to take, and that they're going to come forth in another time, in a time of righteousness. And the devil's work is to put a stop to the Lord's work, to throw a monkey wrench in his gears whenever it's possible. Even going back to what we began with digging away at our freedoms, the liberty that was described in the song that we sang, God is the author of liberty, and we have it because of him, not because we deserved it, not because we invented it, but because God gave it to us. And yet foolish men go on and on fighting the decrees of God, and wise men have the opportunity to find fulfillment and delight and hope in it. And that's the difference between believing that there is a God, that he does exist, and believing God, believing his word. I believe when Marvin Case was here last month that he preached to us on that premise of the difference between acknowledging God and truly believing him. I want to read a familiar story for us that's in the 14th chapter of Matthew, because it deals with believing God. As soon as I get my numbers straightened out here. Jesus, in that chapter, fed 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. You remember that from Sunday school, from before you could read and write. And some don't believe it, they think. But at any rate, he fed them. And at the end of that day, I want to pick up the reading at verse 22. And straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship and go before him unto the other side. They were beside the Sea of Galilee, and it's not very large. So he sent them to go to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone. But the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went unto them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a spirit." And they cried out for fear. But straightway Jesus spake unto them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it be thou, bid me to come to thee on the water." And he said, "Come." And when Peter was come down out of the ship, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said unto him, "O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" He had just seen 5,000 people fed with 5 little fishes and 2 small loaves of bread. And yet, when he came to believing that the Lord would hold him up out of the water, he got faint-hearted. Because it's not in man's makeup, it seems, to really deeply believe. Israel saw the Lord's works over many generations. And still, when they were being admonished to serve the Lord and to worship the Lord, they fell in with the neighboring people, and some of them were quite barbarous and others were more civilized, but they were all idol worshipers, and they fell to worshiping those idols. And many of their kings brought their nation into bondage and difficulty with foreign nations because they too served those gods. Ahab followed his wife Jezebel into the worship of Baal, and it really got out of hand, and they tore down the altars on which sacrifices were made to God. And Jezebel supported 450 priests of Baal and 400 of some other kind of idol worshiping people. And the prophet Elijah rose up against them to show the people of Israel that they were doing the wrong thing. I want to read to you in 1 Kings chapter 18. You know this story too. Verse 17 of chapter 18. And it came to pass, I'm going back a little before my story starts, when Ahab saw Elijah. I better mention to you that because Elijah had prayed to God about the sorry state that Israel was in, the Lord caused it to not rain in Israel for 3.5 years. And they knew that it was because of Elijah. So back to 17 again. When Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said unto him, art thou he that troubleth Israel? And he, that is Elijah, answered, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that ye have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and thou hast followed Balaam. Now therefore send and gather me all Israel unto Mount Carmel, and the prophets Baal 450, and the prophets of the groves 400, which eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent unto all the children of Israel, and gathered the prophets together unto Mount Carmel. And Elijah came unto all the people, and said, How long halt ye between two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people answered him not a word. Then said Elijah unto the people, I, even I, only remain a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. So he said, Let's take two bullocks, young bulls, and we'll offer them up on our altars. You go first. So these 450 men put the wood on their altar, cut the bullock in pieces and put it on the altar, and Elijah said, call down fire. And they spent the whole day. They danced around like they had a coal in their shoe. They jumped on the altar. They cried. They wept. They cut themselves with whatever tools they had, so that they bled all over things. And they carried on the whole day long, and they got nothing. And Elijah wasn't above taunting them a little bit, and he'd say, "Well, you better call louder, because it could be your God's asleep, or maybe he's off hunting or gone on a vacation. You better be louder about it." And in the evening, then he repaired the broken down altar of God and put his wood on it and carved up his bullock and put him on it. He said, dump 4 barrels of water on it. They dumped 4 barrels of water on it. He said, do it again. And they did it again. Do it a third time. So they dumped 12 barrels of water on this offering and on the wood and on the altar, and filled the trench that Elijah had dug around it. Then Elijah turned and prayed to God. And I'm going to read at verse 38. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench, even burnt the rocks. That's fire. Fire will burn rocks, but it takes a tremendous fire, not anything that's ordinary to you and me. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, The Lord, He is the God. The Lord, He is the God. And Elijah said unto them, Take the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape. And they took them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. Well, that's as far as we're going to follow the story. Ahab still didn't believe God. He went and told his wife, he said, Elijah killed those 450 prophets of Baal. And she swore a vile oath, and she said, Let the gods do to me the same as he's done to these men, if he's alive this time tomorrow. Well, she wasn't able to catch up with Elijah, and he survived. And if you'd like to know the rest of that story, I urge you to read it. But it takes a while. It goes clear to the end of the 9th chapter of 2 Kings and tells, because she lived to be an old woman, far beyond the life of her husband, and she came to an evil end. But she said, Elijah is going to be as dead as they are tomorrow, because she wasn't going to accept the God of Israel. She was going to have revenge against him. But how many times has the Church of Christ been exactly where Israel was? How many times in our short history, 175 years, have we halted between two opinions and could go nowhere? Stuck. Because men have a hard time believing God. We read it in Matthew chapter 23. verse 23, the words of Jesus. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe the mint and anise and cumin. If you remember, at that time, the spices all that they had all came from the very far east by a perilous route traveled by camel caravans and besieged by bandits. So they were extremely expensive. And so he said, you give these things, these expensive herbs and spices for tithing, and you do that cheerfully and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone, because he's speaking of their treatment and their attitude toward each other. Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. And we do that. Strain at a small matter until it grows all out of proportion to itself. And it's as bad as to swallow a camel. The scribes and the Pharisees were so full of their own wisdom that to them this was the way. They would debate for years or how many over something as small as it could be and go nowhere. And we've been caught in the same trap. If we look to God, we can make it, we can get along all right. If we fail to look to God, we won't even be able to figure out what we ought to try to learn. What's important enough to learn and do, and what we ought to let go. I want to read for you in the 14th chapter of the book of Revelation. Verses 6 and 7. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people. We believe that we know what that gospel is that he had in his hands and that we have it. And it has to be taught before the end to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. We can't afford to strain at a gnat or swallow a camel. John saw this because it was going to be, not because it was an interesting story. The Lord showed him what was to be. And it goes on, and the angel was there saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. Worship him that made everything. We read this morning in the book of Job where the Lord said, where were you when I did all of these things? When I set the bounds of the sea, and when I raised the earth up and set the seasons in their order, which they still are and will be forever, because he has promised that they won't change as long as time shall last. But here the angel gave the commandment, fear God and give glory to him. When we learn to give the full measure of reverence to God, when all the earth learns to give the full measure of reverence to God, everything else that can be considered is going to take its place. It won't make any difference if it's the life of one person or of a whole nation or of a whole world of nations.